I'd like him to try to stick within the time limits so that we can get as much questions both from Lee up here and from you when we get to it. So the plan of trying to stay within those 2-minute time limits. When we get to the audience participation part, as the debate format tells you, if you direct a question to just one of the candidates, the other two will get 1 minute to respond to whatever the candidate says you're going to ask a question. So we're going to go alphabetically. So I'm going to ask Elise to do, and each of the candidates, as you know from reading this, I think I gave them 5 minutes for an opening statement. So we'll start off with Elise, and we'll go alphabetically down the table to Chris and then to Dimitri on the end. And I'll ask the first question to Chris, because he's the C in the group. And then we'll just go alphabetically from there. So on your questions, each candidate will get 2 minutes. So, Elise.
Can you all hear me okay? Wonderful. Well, first of all, thank you, Tom, and thanks to all of you who helped to organize this. I'm very grateful to be here. I think that I've already made a few friends, so thank you. My name is Elise Galvin, and I'm running for Congress. My family came up to Alaska serving in World War II, and I grew up in Anchorage. I'm a mom of four. I'm a former small business owner and hotel manager and a lifelong advocate for public education here in Alaska. For the past 5 years, I've been a leader of Great Alaska Schools, a grassroots effort I helped launch and grow from 40 to 4,000 people. I organized people all across our state and lobbied for legislators in Juneau and D.C. to hold the line on public education cuts that were devastating our schools. I fought every day for kids, and I will bring this same energy to the campaign, the same things that led to a success at Great Alaska Schools. Strong organization of people, clear messaging on issues critical to them, and that's how we're going to win in November. I'm not a politician, I've never run for office, and I never thought I would run myself. However, I have spent a lot of time trying to effect change in Juneau and in D.C. And I know how to get things done in both places. I know how it works. What I saw in D.C. made me frustrated that people like me were not there solving the problems facing Alaskans. And I decided I needed to step up because the lack of leadership that was there was so clearly not representing our values and, frankly, not getting things done. I know how to organize people, and I know how to get things done. What I'll bring is the tenacious, energetic, and solutions-oriented leadership to Washington that I think is needed. And you can see that in my campaign already. Over 600 Alaskans have signed up to volunteer. And we've raised nearly $600,000 from individuals, not corporations, who want to see me defeat Don Young. They are excited to see a woman, a mom, an Alaskan very much like themselves, who's prepared to solve problems in their lives, address the concerns, not of some big money corporate interests, but of people. Alaska and our nation are at a crossroads right now. And I believe I am the new kind of leader we need for Alaska's future. This election we're about to have will decide whether we really are a government of the people, by the people, and for the people, or whether we are going to give it up to corporations or special interests. And it's very critical. It will decide whether my four kids and all of our kids will have an Alaskan economy that provides a good-paying job, quality health care without worrying about how much a doctor's visit will cost, a strong public education from cradle to career, and the wonderful Alaskan way of life. That's the reason we all cherish living here. This is a federal office, but I don't believe national solutions are always right for Alaska. I'm not running to bring Washington values to Alaska. I'm running to bring Alaska's needs and Alaska's values to Washington. I'm running against Don Young to finally put Alaskans first. Thank you.
Chris?
All right, thank you. Thanks for coming, everybody. My name is Christopher Cummings, and I figured since I imagine you guys are wondering who the heck am I, I'd like to take a couple minutes to tell you about myself. I'm 33 years old. I'm a husband and a proud father of a six-year-old son. I was born and raised in Alaska to a middle-class family. My dad was a cop. My mom was a nurse. And over the years, I've lived everywhere in the state, from Barrow to Ketchikan, big cities to Bush. You know, I've seen it all. I'm nobody particularly special. You know, I'm not a lifelong activist or a successful entrepreneur, and I'm definitely not a politician either. A couple of things about myself. You know, I'm a recovering opiate addict, and I'm somebody who struggles with my mental health, and so that's an important part of my campaign. I'm somebody who has tons of student loans. You know, I'm poor. I'm on Medicaid and food stamps. You know, the social safety net is keeping my family together and safe. You know, but I'm also someone who's fallen hard and picked myself back up. So I guess you could say I'm a little bit resilient. I'm someone with the courage to stand up for what I believe in, even though I face really long odds. I'm self-aware enough to know that I don't have all the answers. I need help sometimes. And most importantly, occasionally I'm even wrong. I'm also someone who has come to understand, like, you know, the passion and the relentlessness that you need when you're an advocate for somebody. My six-year-old son is autistic, and so over the years, you know, we really had to fight to get him the help he needs, especially in a community like this, you know, where there's really, the resources we have, they count, you know, they do great work, but there's just not enough resources. You know, and I'm also someone who's had a taste of success and been a productive member of society, you know, I'm a college graduate, a published author, and had a successful stint working as a bank manager over on POW. I have a number of reasons for running, you know, the two Dons, Don Young and Donald Trump. You know, this has been a lifelong dream. I've been studying politics since I could read, and I believe I have a lot to bring to the table. You know, I believe that the best medicine our democracy can get right now is regular people stepping up and getting involved, you know, not just being satisfied with doing stuff at the local level. We need regular people from the top to the bottom. You know, but the biggest reason I'm running is that I'm tired of losing friends and family to addiction and suicide. You know, I see everyone in power who can make changes just sitting around talking, and in the meantime, people are dying. I think I've got a few ideas to help address the opiate epidemic and the mental health crisis we've got going on in our country today. And so I'm kind of running to bring awareness to this, hopefully maybe break the stigma about addiction and mental health a little bit, you know, by talking about it. So, you know, I figure if I can at least help with that, even if I lose this election, I'll come out ahead, you know, do some good. I feel I'm the candidate, believe it or not, that is best positioned to beat Don Young. You know, I'm radically different from what the party's run out for the last 40 years. Very different. I can do this I don't need much money to do this. You know, I have the real world experience that Congress needs right now. Like I was saying, the best kind of experience a congressman can have is regular, everyday experience, struggling, just trying to survive, you know. I have no political baggage, you know, no record, and I understand Alaska. You know, I've lived in Ketchikan for the last 27 years, so I understand what it's like to be isolated and to have to be, you know, self-reliant and dependent on what we've got here. So, thank you.
Chris for running and standing for his values, and I think it's very important. And it's very good to be here in Ketchikan with him and with all of you. I understand you guys had some tropical weather here lately. Sorry, we brought some rain for you guys from Anchorage. My name is Dimitri Shane. I'm the Democratic candidate for U.S. House of Representatives. A little bit about myself. My mother, I'm an immigrant. I was born in Russia. My mother and I immigrated when I was 12 years old, and we came to Anchorage, Alaska, and I have lived in Anchorage for over 25 years. My mother and I came to a wonderful neighborhood in Anchorage, Fairview. It's a low-income, mixed neighborhood, and it's very diverse, and it was a wonderful way to see America. We came to, you know, we had black kids, Samoan kids, Alaska Native kids, Russian kids, all playing together on the park strip, and it was just a beautiful picture of America, and that's what we should be working towards. My mother and I and my baby sister, through some unfortunate events, ended up living at the Awake Women's Shelter. My mother worked very hard to get us out of that shelter through some help of government assistance, and she was able to move us into a home. And then she worked very hard as a single mother, working at Walmart, working nights, and during daytime she would go to school to get her college degree, and she finally got her college degree as an environmental engineer. And she built and provided a better life for me and my baby sister. And this is who I learned my work ethic from. And after I graduated high school, I got my first job as a fuel plant operator working at the Ted Stevens International Airport. It was a union job. It allowed me to provide for myself. It paid a living wage. And it allowed me to also help my wife, Melissa, make it through college and also make it through medical school. And I got my accounting degree, and I started an accounting business, working as a CPA and accountant, traveling around rural Alaska, working with Alaska Native Village Councils, tribal corporations, tribal governments, municipal governments. And I would fly to a village, sleep on the floor in a place like Newtok or Tununuk. You know, nothing greater than being invited to somebody's home to eat some fish head soup and some potatoes with some beach greens and some seal oil, and then be invited for a steam. It's a really wonderful experience and a way to get to know Alaska Native people. I think that's important in this race, to have a connection to Alaska Native people. My wife Melissa and I have 6 children. My wife is a Inupiaq. All 6 of my kids are Inupiaq. We adopted 4 children. And it has been a very wonderful, enriching experience in our lives. And I, not too long ago, retired from accounting. I started an e-commerce company. I invented a product. Now, it fortunately has become relatively successful. And I sell and manufacture planter boxes all over the world. And I did this all from Alaska. And I believe I have some experience in regards to international trade and commerce. The reason I decided to enter this race is because I'm an immigrant. And I cherish American values. The values of free press, free speech, our independent judiciary, the notion that all of us and none of us are above the law. And I feel that these American values and principles and pillars are under attack right now. They're under attack from abroad, and they're not being defended by our representatives in Congress. Folks like Dong Young have sold us the false narrative that our government cannot solve problems, that our government is worthless, and in fact, it deserves being attacked. And they don't need to stop these attacks. And the only way to fight back and protect our democracy and protect our country is to elect leaders from new generation of people to protect our democracy. Folks that believe the government is there to solve problems. And this is why I'm running on clear solutions. Single-payer Medicare for all is a solution to our healthcare crisis. Repealing Trump tax cuts is a solution so we can fund education and fund infrastructure. Investing in renewable energy projects, as a solution to mitigate climate change and to bring jobs to Alaska. These are all clear solutions that we need to be running on, and this is the way we will be done young. Because things like healthcare, for example, 30% of our state budget is spent on healthcare. Alaskans are hurting. Families are hurting. Businesses are hurting. The state of Alaska is going bankrupt. We have to present a solution. We cannot expect to win unless we provide a clear solution. Now, I believe I'm a different type of candidate because I have been endorsed by Our Revolution Alaska, a group that's affiliated with Bernie Sanders. We have recruited hundreds and hundreds of volunteers all over Alaska to take on this challenge. We are sign waving. My campaign has generated an enormous amount of enthusiasm. I'm being endorsed by doctors across the entire state of Alaska. So we're bringing together people from all over the state, individuals, businesses, physicians, all these people who realize that what's going on in our country is not right. And the only way to do this is to run on clear solutions. And this is why I'm running, and this is how we will beat Dong Young. And we don't have to compromise our values. We have to run on clear solutions and articulate the benefit of those solutions. Thank you all for having me here.
This first question is wide open. We tried to make all of them as open-ended as we could, but they don't get any better than this one. As our representative, what would you work on to address concerns that people have concerning the Affordable Care Act?
That one's coming. We're starting with me, right? So I'll share a personal experience. You know, I used to be a janitor not too long ago, and I made enough money that I made too much for Medicaid, but I didn't make enough to qualify for Obamacare subsidy, right, to sign up through the exchange. So I was in that gap with no health care. There's one problem right there that we can fix pretty easy. I believe in single-payer health care, or whatever you want to call it. For me, the main question is equal access to health care. I don't think anybody, I don't feel that price should be an issue when you go to the doctor. I don't feel that anybody should be making a profit off somebody else's misery. I do believe the doctors and the nurses that are working miracles deserve to be paid well. But I feel that, really, I feel at the end of the day, I feel that the insurance system is failing us. Private insurance is failing us. So I support moving towards Medicaid for all. I don't know how long it would take. I don't know, the details, but I know that's what our country needs right now. Thank you.
Is it my turn?
Yep.
All right. So Obamacare is being attacked and is being dismantled. They're attacking coverage for pre-existing conditions. They're attacking coverage for elderly. They're attacking coverage for prescription. And this will continue because our government has not reaffirmed that health care in our country is a human right. And the way we reaffirm that health care is a human right and is a right of every American is by passing single-payer Medicare for all. That's what needs to be done. We need to get away from half measures because half measures is what gave us Donald Trump. And if we want to avoid such craziness in the future, we need to stand firm on our values, reaffirm the fact that healthcare is a human right, and we need to move boldly towards single-payer Medicare for all. Even the Koch brothers now agree that it is more cost-effective for us to implement single-payer Medicare for all. So it is the right thing to do financially. As a business person, as an accountant, I will tell you it's the right thing to do financially. It is the right thing to do morally, and it is the right thing to do to win elections. And that's what we need to be doing. If we want to win elections in the state of Alaska and all over the country, we need to be speaking to the pocketbooks of the American people. American people are sick and tired of paying thousands and thousands of dollars for health insurance. They're sick and tired of going bankrupt. So no more half measures. Let's connect with American people. Let's connect with American businesses and boldly move forward towards single-payer Medicare for all.
All right. Well, I hope I don't sound like a broken record here. But it's true. Our out-of-control health care costs are standing in the way of our economic growth more than anything else. Not only is it the dominant, it's really the dominant cost to our public budgets, such as school districts. But if too many small businesses are unable to expand due to health care costs. Everyone deserves quality, comprehensive health care without worrying, as my family did when I was pregnant with my second one. I was up almost all night because if anything had gone wrong, we would have been bankrupt. And as you probably are aware, about more than half of the bankruptcies right now to this day are due to health care crises. So no family should have to go through that, and they will. I do believe that everybody should be able to pay to be able to have access to comprehensive health care, and that it must include coverage for illness and injury, and also coverage for preventive care, maternal and reproductive care, mental health, vision, and dental. And I know we can get there. In Congress, I will fight his efforts to take away care that was referred to earlier, and it's absolutely unconscionable what's been going on. Our own current Don Young did vote to take away pre-existing conditions. Children's health insurance program, can you imagine? Which would affect more than 15,000 Alaskan children if they became law. So I say let's open up for now, right this minute we can do things. Let's open up healthcare exchanges across state lines so Alaska can team up with other small population states to expand our coverage pool, which will lower costs. Let's fight Big Pharma right now and support legislation and policies to lower the cost of prescription drugs right now. Let's increase Medicare reimbursement rates so that they cover the cost of care right now. Because right now, providers in Alaska are struggling. And let's make it easier for Alaskans to find doctors who accept Medicare. I'll stop there if I'm over my time.
Oh, you're good. Thank you, all of you. We are all aware of information indicating that the Russian government hacked into our election system, and some of us have experienced virus attacks on our computers and hacking into our social media accounts. The question is, what can Congress do to make our election system safer, to make the Internet safer, and provide equal access for all users?
I think the first thing that Congress needs to do is to stop denying the fact that these attacks have taken place and hold folks accountable for these attacks and to make sure that the Mueller investigation goes all the way forward, is concluded, and justice is carried out in the way it should be carried out in the United States of America, in an open, transparent manner. No one is above the law. That includes our president. So it's imperative that we have leaders in Congress who do not deny these attacks, because we can't fix something if we continue to get bombarded with this propaganda that nothing is wrong. Because we all know that something is wrong, and we need to be taking action to fix it. We need to be investing and cybersecurity. We need to be providing additional funding to Homeland Security to invest in cybersecurity. All of us need to take personal responsibility for information that we read and disseminate on the internet, because at the end of the day, if something is not true, we should not be repeating it. We live in an age of proliferation of false information, and when we hear false information being spread, we should be quick to call it out, and call it out as such. So Congress needs to increase funding for cybersecurity and also to hold itself and others accountable for these types of attacks.
Thank you.
Tom, would you please repeat that question? I haven't heard that one. Sorry.
The current administration has threatened. Excuse me. That's the next one. We are all aware of information indicating that the Russian government hacked into our election system, and some of us have experienced virus attacks on our computers and hacking into social media accounts. What can Congress do to make use of the Internet safer and provide current equal access to all users?
Okay. I absolutely agree with Dimitri. We need to strengthen the amount of resources that we're putting into cybersecurity. I know that there was an attempt to do that recently, and that did not pass. And I think it's time for us to make sure that we get our heads wrapped around that and maybe figure out why it didn't happen. The Mueller case absolutely needs to be strengthened. There's something that Congress can do now to at least enshrine it so that that can carry through all the way to it to fruition. We need to make sure we follow that through. With regard to Facebook and other social media opportunities, I think that it was one thing to have a hearing, but maybe we need to now get some teeth to it. I don't think that we've done that yet, and it might be time to make sure that we have a task force really studying that from the government's perspective. And then I also think that it's important that we think about education, public education in this area, because we need to grow a citizenry of critical thinkers. And so I think that we have every opportunity here to also discuss the importance of public education. We have been missing the boat here when we do not ensure and strengthen that our public education system is allowing us to grow citizens who are engaged and also educated to know how to make those critical thinking decisions as they see so many things on social media that look like they are real news. I also worry about freedom of speech right now. That's another really critical piece of this. And so we need to find that balance, but also grow critical thinkers here in Alaska and in the entire nation.
All right, so I'm not going to repeat too much what anybody else said. I certainly think a couple of things. I think the Mueller investigation should continue. It would be ideal if partisanship could be removed from that. You know, this is a serious issue, but it seems like politics is getting in the middle of it. And so it's frustrating. It's hard to figure out, you know, what's true and what's not. I believe that we should go back to paper in elections and have a paper trail. I believe something like 40 states do. Alaska certainly does. But I think that backup is important in case something does happen. We've also, you know, got to be prepared for what if something does happen. How are we going to clean up the mess? I think cyberspace has just kind of become a world of its own. And right now it's unregulated. It's like the Wild West on the Internet. You know, what happens in cyberspace affects us in our everyday life. And so if social media, Twitter, Facebook, whatever, isn't going to step up and regulate this issue, I think Congress can act. I think Congress should act to regulate social media. I know there's, of course, a free speech issue, but this is cyber warfare that's going on right now. It's, the battlefield is invisible. We can't see it, but it's real. Russia's trying to mess with us, and we're not really putting the resources into it. We're not fighting it like it's an actual war. They're trying to disrupt our democracy. And so, of course, the last thing, part of this is on us. We've got to take responsibility to educate ourselves, educate our children. I think perhaps, we can start early with kids and start teaching them civics, not wait till high school. Start getting civic education in elementary school and middle school so that we have smart, intelligent, discerning citizens. That's all I got.
Thank you. This question, I think, at least starts.
Okay.
The current administration has threatened terrorists in a lot of areas, and we still do not know what will happen. But how would you, as our representative, address the effects caused to timber and or fishing, for example? Both are very important in this part of the state.
So I think I was given a question around fisheries and tariffs, but it fits for everything, frankly.
Yeah.
First of all, the primary issue here is that we have a president who is single-handedly coming up with foreign policy that is without a plan. There's not a strategy. And it's directly impacting Alaskans and other sectors throughout the nation. So fisheries, for example, boy, when you talk about a 25% tariff, that's a huge impact. The Trump tariffs, they're damaging to Alaska's fisheries industry, including the Southeast. We're seeing impacts on the markets that Alaskans rely on. Representative Young's silence on these ill-conceived policies is very telling and very troubling. We need a representative who will stand up for Alaska in the face of wrong-headed policies from the Trump administration, not sit obediently to the side. That's the key. As Alaska's representative in Congress, as your first Congresswoman, I will sound the alarm when the Trump administration threatens Alaskans' interests. And when I say sound the alarm, I think there are things that we can do besides just come up with a press release. And that's what we need to be looking at, is holding our president accountable. Thank you.
All right, so, you know, as I prepared and researched this question, it's the idea I got is it seems like nobody really knows what's going to happen right now. It's going to take some time for tariffs to really start to impact our fisheries. But the big way that tariffs affect fisheries here in Alaska is that, you know, we've been doing a lot of work with China to develop markets in China. We put a marketing, ASMI, the fisheries marketing group, has put in money, lots of money, in China. China's a huge developing market, and putting a tariff on it, you know, they can go get salmon from Norway or Chile or, you know, wherever. So we're going to lose that market if these tariffs go into place. And they don't just affect salmon, you know, they affect the dive fisheries. You know, I used to work, when I was in Craig, I worked with a Chinese buyer that would come over to my blue ducks. And, you know, that's going to end. And that's a big market for us. The U.S. Chamber of Commerce estimated that the tariffs would have about a $1 billion impact on fisheries nationwide. And so, you know, like we saw, it seems like the president just wants to pay industries off, you know, just like what we saw with the farmers. You know, they want to grow crops, but instead we're going to give them, welfare, you know. So I think Congress right now is at really weak in regards to the president, and I think Congress can step up and take back some of its foreign policy responsibility. I think Congress should act to review these tariffs, and I don't know, but this is a big deal. You know, we export about almost $1 billion in fish to China last year. And that's like 40 or 50% of what we export here in Alaska. I don't know. You know, it's going to take some time. So, to be determined, I guess. Thank you.
Yeah, I think it's pretty clear that the Trump administration and its tariffs and the trade wars are not helping Alaska's economy. Fishery is one of the biggest employers in our state, and increasing tariffs and starting a trade war with China only, you know, makes our goods more expensive overseas. I have traveled to China, and it's a very big, you know, growing country with a vibrant economy. And China is very important to Alaska. In fact, Governor Walker has led a delegation to China trying to expand trade with China. And the Trump administration is focused on starting trade wars. And we are starting trade wars not only with China, we're starting trade wars with Canada, and in the process of starting one with Mexico. And the Trump administration is doing things like using national security laws to designate, you know, Canada a national security threat and to justify raising tariffs on our allies, our neighbors. So the president is clearly out of control and is uninformed and uneducated in this matter. And we need people in Congress who, like myself, who understand global trade. My business, for example, has been affected by these ridiculous tariffs. And my business, we build large planter boxes. And the steel supplier on the West Coast imports steel from Korea. And they're just not able, because of these tariffs, there's a shortage of steel on the West Coast. And so these projects are sitting there idle. And many projects are being canceled, so American jobs are being lost because there's not enough steel supply on the West Coast of the United States. So these tariffs are hurting Alaskans. These tariffs are hurting the larger American economy. For example, Harley-Davidson recently announced they're moving out of the United States as part of their operations. So if an iconic company like Harley-Davidson is taking their business somewhere else, you see what's happening with these tariffs. So, yeah, we need more people in government who understand national trade, and at times tariffs are important to protect American jobs and to make sure that we have a good level playing field. But just approaching it in such a chaotic manner with such little thought to it, and it just seems inappropriate and dangerous to be starting trade wars, especially with our allies.
Thank you. I think Chris starts off first on this question. We are surrounded by a variety of natural resources in our area. Many of us would like to develop those resources over time to create jobs and a more diversified economy. How do you envision your role as our representative in Congress in assisting with that process?
With natural resources?
Yeah,
I think that's one of the keys. That's why Don Young gets reelected, is because he understands natural resource policy. And that's important for Alaska. We've got 60% or whatever of our state and federal under federal control, and the, you know, the other 30-40% under state control. So I'm an advocate of mixed use, responsible development, for the Tongass, for example. I do support the Alaska's exemption from the roadless rule. Not to go crazy and rebuild the pulp mill and industrial logging, but for access to hydro projects, just between communities. I just saw in the paper, I think today or tomorrow, yesterday, that we're going to get an Alaska-specific roadless rule. So I support that too. I support efforts to take back control of state, to put as much land and put as much natural resources under state control as we can. I believe that local control of natural resources is the best policy. I think Congress has some room to act. It's delegated a lot of its natural resources policymaking to the executive branch, to the Forest Service. So I think Congress needs to take back the authority it's delegated. And if it's going to impose a law like the roadless rule on 58 million acres of land, then Congress should do that. It's a huge, massive issue. So I support a small timber industry. I used to work in Craig. I saw the impact of Viking lumber over there. It's one source of good, steady-paying jobs. I think it's about time to transition to the second growth. I don't support going out and cutting too much more of the old growth than what we have. Are we going to have a question about mining later?
Yeah.
Okay. I'll stop there.
Okay. Okay, thank you. Dmitry?
So, Don Young wins because he has a very strong economic message. And his message is drill and mine and extract anywhere, any way you can. That's pretty much Dong Young's economic message. So to win against Dong Young, we have to figure out what is our competing economic message. What do we propose? Because Dong Young is the champion of that. He is a champion of natural resource development. So what are we bringing to the table? How do we propose we diversify our economy? Because we have half a century now, oil drilling and mining and timber, and we seem to be getting not richer, we seem to be getting poorer. So what is our message? How do we bring in revenue? How do we diversify our economy? And this is why I'm running on the platform of single-payer Medicare for all, because this is a second source of revenue. I propose diversifying our budget and our revenue stream by bringing in billions and billions of dollars in healthcare revenue into the state of Alaska. Single-payer Medicare for all would bring in at least $5 billion of federal revenue into the state of Alaska. We can have good jobs, like my wife does as a physician, nurses, healthcare workers. These are all good paying jobs, and this is federal revenue to the state of Alaska. So to beat Don Young, we need to have a competing economic message. And I'm the only candidate in this race who has an economic message that rivals that of Don Young. So we need to diversify our economy, and we need to diversify it with healthcare. And yes, natural resource development is important, and I will work on allowing and pursuing responsible natural resource and state development policy at the federal level. But we do need to diversify our economy because we can't be a one-trick pony, as my opponent likes to say. Thank you.
Tom, would you repeat the question again? I just want to make sure. It was around timber.
Yeah, we are surrounded by a variety of natural resources in our area. Many of us would like to develop those resources over time to create jobs and a more diversified economy. How do you envision your role as our representative in Congress to help with that process?
Okay. So with regard to this area and timber specifically, I would just offer that I do support the roadless rule in Tongass Forest, the National Forest. I do appreciate that there are times when locally, sometimes some roads where it's demonstrably needed, locals will balance between the economic change and the environmental impact, and that's what the locals, I believe, would and should have their input in. But we haven't really invested in the local timber and wood products here. I think it's important that we think about the economic advantages and jobs in that sense. I believe that it strikes, with regard to the roadless rule, I think that it strikes an appropriate balance between conservation of old growth forest areas and allowing the timber industry to economically log areas previously disturbed. With regard to the policy and the use of the national forest, I think, as with most public lands, I support a multi-use approach, similar to what you were talking about. I believe that we can find balanced methods to allow competing considerations to be reasonably accommodated. And I think it's important to us to also consider that there are some new ideas out there with regard to diversifying our economy that we really need to capitalize on. In Alaska, we have the ideal models for how to build homes, for example, in rural Alaska using renewable energy. And we can use some of what we can produce here, but also combine with that some of our renewable energies here, whether it's wind, solar, geothermal. We have prototypes already up in Fairbanks at the Cold Climate Housing Research Center. And it's very exciting to look at those models and know that they've been actually designed with using input from each of the regions in the state, where we have families living in rural areas, and really they can't afford it because of the energy costs. But we can be the state that's on the forefront of building these homes, and that brings jobs that I think will be very, very helpful here. And I think it's necessary that we talk about that as well, because this is going to be a time for us where we need to come up with jobs for the 70% of us who are not going on to four-year college, but can get apprenticeships and move ourselves into these jobs of building homes in appropriate areas that allow our families to live in rural Alaska in perpetuity and afford it. So there's a win-win-win everywhere with that.
Dimitri, you lead off on this one. The road system in southeast Alaska is the state ferry system. The current occupant of our only U.S. House seat, as chair of the Transportation Committee, was able to secure significant funding for the state highway system, at least until we lost that chairmanship for playing favorites with other states like Florida. If you become our representative to the U.S. House, how do you envision your role in securing adequate funding for the ferry system as our highway?
So I have been fortunate to campaign throughout southeast Alaska. I've been to Juneau, Skagway, Haines, Sitka, and now here in Ketchikan. I have taken a ferry ride overnight from Haines to Juneau and got to sleep on the floor and have a hamburger and so forth. And I get to really get in touch with and see how folks in Southeast live and how they depend on the ferry system. So I truly understand the connection that people in this region have to the marine highway and how important it is for this life here in this region. I think we need another ocean-going ferry that's vital, and we do need more funding for transportation funding for the state of Alaska. Of course, it is problematic because the state of Alaska right now is going through very difficult financial times. There are budget constraints, and our legislators in Juneau seem to be using a lot of our tax revenue to give out tax breaks to the oil companies instead of investing in transportation. So I think we need independent leadership. We need people who are not connected to lobbyists. And likewise, this is needed in the state of Alaska, and it's also needed in Washington, D.C. And I will make sure that I will get on the Transportation Committee and make sure to work towards increasing transportation funding to the state of Alaska. And again, I will join the Medicare for All caucus in U.S. House of Representatives, and we will get single-payer Medicare for All passed, and that will free up 30% of our state budget to invest in ferries, to invest in roads, and to invest in transportation across Alaska, because that should be a priority of our government.
Yeah, so I think that it's very critical that the marine highway system is considered just like any other road system in the United States when it comes to getting support. And while we have had some support nationally with regard to helping out with the ports, I think that we need a lot more. That's one thing that is clear to me. I lived in Juneau for a few years, and I've taken the ferry all over the place all the time, and I know that it's not just about people enjoying a ride here or there. It's about people being able to bring goods that are necessary. It's also about people, tourists, coming into our communities and spending their dollars and changing the economy here. It's really important, and I know here in Ketchikan you now have the administrative center here for the ferry system. It's important. Those are good jobs. They're great jobs. Frankly, I've heard just today that it's cheaper to take a cruise ship than to take the ferry right now. Are you kidding me? I mean, geez, this is ridiculous. And with the Columbia being down, that impacts everything. everything for these communities, and not just here. Corolla is the same. I hear it from Sitka. I've heard it from Valdez. I've heard it from Whittier. It's everywhere. So this is an Alaskan issue, and frankly, it becomes bigger. It becomes a national issue when we don't have a society here that can protect the longest coastline in the entire United States. We're not safe if we can't get goods delivered from one place to another. That's really important, and I would certainly be strident and be an advocate. I think that it's a fundamental aspect of our state economy, and we must protect our marine highway system and make sure it's enhanced. One thing that the federal government could do to improve the system and lower costs for users is, of course, invest in the southeast ports. Not only are these ports vital economic engines, but they serve as important components to the national defense, particularly when I'm successful in increasing the presence and investment in the Coast Guard. That's huge. The role of the Arctic in the national defense has not been adequately used to increase investment in the Coast Guard and related infrastructure in Alaska. And I'll change that. I think it's critical.
All right. Did you go on Chris?
I got the very question now. Growing up in Southeast, the ferry has a special place in my heart. You know, I remember taking it to basketball trips to Wrangell or Petersburg, or going down to Prince Rupert and playing a bunch of Canadians for a little bit. The only time I ever got seasick was it was blowing 80 across the bow on a trip to Petersburg, and I was in the bathroom the whole ferry ride going up. The key question I see with the ferry is, what's more important? Cost, you know, cheap fares, or broad, expansive service? For some of the feeder routes for the ferry, maybe we could provide funding to help, like the IFA. I'm thinking of the IFA, how it's got 85% fare box recovery. It only needs a little bit of public subsidy. And I think some of these smaller routes from communities, you know, from Angoon or Huna to Juneau, like maybe we can get an IFA or something going and kind of, I don't know, contract that out. Because the IFA works. You know, it's dependable, it's reliable, and I spent 4 years over in POW, and that's how I got back and forth. Almost never late, almost always, on time. A couple of issues that I think the federal funding can help. We need to maintain the aging fleet. You know, those boats are all 50 years old, our mainliners. They keep going, but it's going to be more expensive to maintain those boats in the long run than investing in a new ferry. And I think, too, I've heard that they're talking about making the ferry system a public corporation, Alaska Housing Corporation or AIDEA. So to take politics out of the ferry, to let it be run like a business. There's every administration change, there's a leadership change in the ferry at the top. And that constant turnover makes for just short-term planning. Nobody's planning in the long run for the ferry right now. We're just trying to make it through today. So it's going to be, I don't think it would be a huge investment relative to what we spend on other things to kind of help establish some feeder routes and then improve the mainline routes. I think the key question is we just need more money for the ferry. I don't know where it's hard to get, and the state's only got so much, so yeah, it's a money question,
I think at least start this one. The bypass mail system where that supports small air carriers and providing transportation to and from small villages, it provides a stable source of revenue to those carriers, but it's been under attack. And so the question is, what could you, as our representative in Congress, do to support that system to continue in operation.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Well, I think, again, it is vital. It's just as a right for every American to be able to get mail. The importance of that bypass mail system, I don't think it can be overstated for rural Alaska. I know that in Fort Yukon, this year, in fact, their post office shut down. And it turns out it was because someone had passed away, but they didn't have the extra staffing there. And so when that shut down, people were not getting groceries. They were not getting medicine. Really important things. And I think that without the financial support of the U.S. Postal Service, the regular air service to many communities throughout Alaska would not continue. Ted Stevens was a steadfast defender of bypass mail service, and I will be just as tenacious when it comes to threats to this critical service. It's everything. I've spoken to the people who lived there in Fort Yukon this year, and I got to hear from them how angry they were. I've also heard from others throughout rural Alaska about how important those jobs are. So I think it's important that we think of it in many ways, not just the service, but the jobs, and also the continuity that we need to have in order to feel connected to the important tools and survival pieces that keep us living.
So the bypass mail, you know, the post office has a universal service obligation that they'll deliver mail to anybody, anywhere. And so bypass mail, because it's all palleted up and shipped, you know, in pallets, it saves money versus if those boxes were shipped individually in parcel posts. That estimated bypass mail saves $50 million over shipping stuff parcel posts. So this is actually a money-saving program. A byproduct of this, of course, is that it makes air travel safer, cheaper, and more reliable, which then makes shipping costs go down because they've got the passenger support to kind of subsidize that. I know how important I spent a summer in King Sam and working at the bank, and mail there, like, everything comes in the mail. We would get $250,000 in the mail for our ATM, and boxes and boxes of pennies come in the mail. And we got to document all that junk. So, yeah, I mean, that was eye-opening. And the thing, if bypass mail goes away, you know, like Cordova, the milk run will go away. That bypass mail subsidizes the milk run. You know, Petersburg, Ringo, Cordova aren't going to be getting 747s if there's no bypass mail. And I think, you know, having that jet come in once a day or twice a day is an important thing. You know, it keeps people connected in our communities. And so, yeah, in Congress, I'd be a steadfast defender. I mean, this keeps our state running, and it saves money. So I think it should be obvious. Anyway.
Adrian?
Yeah, so when I worked as a CPA and accountant in rural Alaska, you know, I would go to Bethel, and I would usually fly to a village like Quinnahawk, and my favorite airline to take was UDair. It's not fancy. It's a little, like, old plane that's over 50 years old, and there's duct tape everywhere, and a crack in the door that you can see the ground when you're flying. But, you know, but they had a good schedule. They were in and out of the villages like this, so you can get in and get out fast. And the way they were able to do it, because you would have one passenger and the rest of it would be bypass mail. So it makes it economical for this little airline to operate in rural Alaska. And the bypass mail was such a vital thing for a place like Quinnahawk, for example. The 600 people that live there, they depend on this service. And, you know, when I lived in Bethel, I think a very effective tool of passing these and protecting this type of legislation that Ted Stevens was doing very successfully was he would organize tours of rural Alaska. And when I lived in Bethel, Ted Stevens showed up with Dan anyway, and they stood there in front of the hospital and they gave a speech about working together to serve the interests of their states. And that's what we need to get back to, bipartisan work to protect our, to work together across the aisle to make sure that we get things done, and everybody's common interest is solved, is served. So, yeah, I think we need to get someone with higher energy in there than Don Young, and we need to get people on a plane, and we need to get folks up here to Alaska from Congress to see how remote these villages are and how people depend on this service. And I will definitely fight to protect the bypass mail contracts in the U.S. House of Representatives.
Thank you.
I think I've already spoken.
Yeah.
Yeah, I think Chris may talk on this. How do you envision the role of the federal government in supporting research on resource development and the environment?
Yeah, let me get some notes here. Can you repeat the question one more time?
How do you envision the role of the federal government in supporting research on resource development and the environment?
I think what I see from the administration is I feel like science is under attack, you know. Politics is being injected in places that it never has been before. The administration seems to just, you know, it's a drill baby drill administration. I'm not against development. It pays for my kid to go to school. You know, it pays for the roads out here. Oil does. I think we do a lot of things right in Alaska when it comes to natural resources. We haven't had Exxon Valdez accepted. We haven't had any other major disasters. You know, our operating mines are operating, you know, cleanly. Our timber industry is preparing to shift to second growth, and our mining industry. I mean, that's where the real potential is in Southeast. Is our mines. I think we're gonna get into that later, probably. I'm for Alaskan-led development, you know, natural resource development that comes from Alaskans, not from D.C. I think that local input and local control when it comes to natural resources is, that's important. That's what makes it work is when local people have input. So that's what I really support is trying to get natural resources decision made on the state level by people by people in the Tongass, not by people in a building in D.C. So that's all I got.
Well, I think science is good. I think science is very good. Science is very important. I have, for example, traveled in China, and kids in China are studying science. While we in this country have gotten to a point where we're hostile towards science and scientists, and there's selective application to where we feel like when science benefits us, we will make that decision. When it doesn't, we'll just call it fake news or something like that. And we should get away from that. That's not appropriate. That's not good for the future of our children. And it's very concerning when you have projects like Pebble Mine, for example, where all science points to the fact that if this project is to go forward, it would destroy the salmon habitat. And we can't ignore science because these are real decisions. We're talking about the livelihood of thousands of people, things that have been there for thousands of years now. We need an EPA, an Environmental Protection Agency, that's staffed by scientists, not the coal industry. And we shouldn't be fast-tracking resource development projects like there is no tomorrow, because that's what I feel is happening now. Science is being disregarded, and it's resource development at any cost. Monuments, national forests, natural refuges, everything's on the table. And we really should be more respectful of our children and our grandchildren, because not all of this belongs to us. A lot of this belongs to our children and grandchildren. So that's my thoughts.
Yeah, I agree. I think I'll say that it actually belongs to generations before us, many thousands of years before us, and ahead of us. And that we always, of course, have to look at the balance between the economic gain and versus the environmental impact. And certainly never lose sight of the fact that resources like fisheries, when they're gone, they're gone. We already know that with Oregon, with Washington. And now we're already starting to wonder what's going on right now. I understand you didn't have your derby this year, right? You hope you might get the derby later. Maybe you'll get the silver derby if it's better. But people are feeling this everywhere up and down the state. And Bethel, I went up and down the Cusk. And I was so excited to be able to visit the fish camps in late June. And instead, they were ghost towns. I mean, this is a reality. And so it's very important that we not only think about these decisions now, that we're not letting corporate decision makers do the real, have the power, I should say. It's important that we let science dictate and research dictate how we do the work. And it's also important that we put enough money into the research and the science so that we're sure that we're getting the full picture. My understanding is some of the reasons that people are worried right now is that there haven't been enough dollars in research to get us the important information we need, and so sometimes things are progressing on in ways they shouldn't because we don't have the right information. So I think it's very important that NOAA gets what it needs. I think it's important that we look at our UAF, UAS, other universities who are doing some of the best research in the world with regard to climate change. And don't cut them by 20%, but instead give them more investment than ever. This is becoming an issue beyond just what I would call resources and jobs at this point. This is about being global stewards. This is about making sure that we are here for generations after generations with a food resource that's right next to us. And I wanted to add, too, that I think we need to think beyond just resources and environment, and then we need to look at what we can do then to front-end being better global stewards so that we're sure to keep these things. We're 4% of the population using 19% of the energy here. We need to start thinking about that so that we can ensure that we're not denigrating or making worse the erosion that's happening all over and creating more stressed environments for the habitat for the fish. We need to think about mining. Certainly, I think that the pebble mine is the wrong mine at the wrong place. Generally speaking, smaller everything usually works out better. And we need to consider that for mills, for mines. I think that there's something to be said for that, but more importantly, that we have local input on anything that's done when it comes to development. I'd like to bring back coastal management. It's time to have local input as we're making any decisions around infrastructure.
Thank you. Dimitri, I think you lead off on this one.
All right.
We've got a question coming up that addresses specifically activities in the Arctic, but this question also relates to the Coast Guard. We rely on services of the Coast Guard in a variety of emergency situations, but they have a much larger function. As a representative in Congress, what would you do to support their work?
Well, something we can be working on and supporting right now, for example, the Senate just got a bill out to President Trump, and it funds 6 icebreakers for the Coast Guard. And now, when and if that bill gets signed, it will be U.S. House's responsibility to make sure those 6 icebreakers are funded. So I will be there making sure that there's adequate funding to construct these new icebreakers and to make sure that Coast Guard has adequate funding to maintain the level of readiness that it needs to.
Thank you.
I agree. We absolutely need to ensure. We have, Russia has 20-some cutters icebreakers that are good for the northern seas, and ours are too small and not enough. And I don't even know that 6 will be enough. I'm very, very concerned right now with our president doing most of his foreign policy on Twitter, and we are the closest to North Korea. We've got a lot of issues here, and we need to be able to be mobile and get to these different places. The Coast Guard also needs their forts, large vessel forts, and that will help us in many other ways economically with regard to lowering transportation costs. But I absolutely, I'm a champion of increasing Coast Guard presence in Alaska and fully funding its current activities in Southeast Alaska. I understand you just got the official Coast Guard city status. All right, that's great, having a base. But the advantages of having more Coast Guard vessels patrolling the waters are easily identified, from fishery safety and, of course, safety all in every other way, and being there first and with regard to any environmental concern as well. The key is making additional Coast Guard presence in Alaska a national priority, and to do that, we need to talk about climate change more and increasing the role of the Arctic in national defense. We need the icebreakers we talked about, but I think more, and the new Coast Guard deployment stations up and down Alaska coast. I will use every tool at my disposal to accomplish this goal, without a doubt.
Yeah, so the Coast Guard, I appreciate the importance Coasties have here in Ketchikan and in Southeast. I feel that one big issue, the Arctic, of course, we need deep water ports up in the Arctic. We need to have somewhere to put those icebreakers. So I've heard talk about putting it in port in Nome or Kotzebue. And I think that should be a priority. We're going to have, the UN just approved the shipping rate through the Bering Sea, so we're going to, or through the Bering Strait. So we're going to start having traffic coming down through the Bering Strait. And we're not prepared for that. If something happened, if a vessel hit a rock or something, the Coast Guard's 1,000 miles away in Kodiak, we're not ready for something like that. As a janitor, I used to clean the Coast Guard base, so I got to know them pretty well and kind of see what's going on down there. And there's a lot of good stuff going on down there. They've got some really good people working down there. I think it's a money issue. The Coast Guard doesn't have the resources right now to do its job. The Arctic is going to be wide open. It's coming. And I don't think enough attention is being paid to it. So the icebreakers are great, but we need a port, we need a base, we need helicopters in the north. And down here, I think we just keep on going. The Coast Guard does a pretty dang good job down here. I keep them going with all that.
Dimitri, we rely, Lisa's turn. Activities in the Arctic will have an effect all over the state. What is the role of the federal government in resource development and or environmental protection in the Arctic?
And are you referring to offshore oil development, or what are you referring to? I'm sorry.
That's a pretty open-ended question. There's all kinds of stuff that could be happening up there in a relatively short period of time. I don't know which one it's going to be.
Okay.
First.
Well,
we've addressed some issues with the Coast Guard.
Yeah, sure.
All kinds of stuff.
Oh, we have everything going already up there. Even cruise ships are now going up north. And they're talking about oil development, which I'm very, very, very wary of. We have no way of cleaning up any problem on broken ice there. Let's be frank about that. And there needs to be somebody to stand up and really talk about that. I'm very concerned. But also, the other activities that are potentially there. We know we have subsistence activities that have been happening for thousands of years. That needs to be protected. And I certainly would be very strong about ensuring that we have opportunities to protect those activities that have been happening forever there, that need to be really kept safe. And if we do have a cruise ship situation like we have out here at your harbor, boy, it's going to change the whole way it looks up there. And we need to ensure that we're working with other countries. It's going to look a little bit more like we've done already with the Fisheries Management Council. The council has had to come together with representation from all over. I think we'll have to do something similar to make sure that we're keeping those waters safe. I think additionally we need to have much more research done in those areas. We really don't know a lot about it. NOAA's been studying for tidal work, and of course ocean acidification and the warming and all of the other work with around climate change. But we really, it behooves us to make sure we get ourselves in there and are part of all of the work that's happening and commerce. Commerce is going, we have a lot more opportunity than ever before, as it's like Chris mentioned, we're going to be seeing a lot more shipping, and we are the first hub, just like we are right now in Anchorage with regard to all of the cargo activity. And that's a lot of activity. It's actually a significant amount of the revenue for the state. So we need to make sure that we're keeping our environmentally friendly regulations up to speed, as much as also ensuring that we're getting a piece of the pie and being protective around our commerce.
Thank you. Chris?
Yeah, all right. So I think with the Arctic, the key question is, are we going to develop it or are we going to preserve it? What, you know? There's certainly a lot of opportunities. You know, I think fisheries are one thing that might open up. You know, nobody's rushes fishing in the Arctic Ocean, but we're not doing much. But I see that in the future. You know, transportation, of course. Like Elise mentioned, that's going to be a crucial hub. And then I think, too, national security is going to be a big issue in the Arctic. We're one of a few, 8 or 12 nations, I don't remember, that border the Arctic. And, you know, we've got one country that's, you know, Russia's making a claim. They've sent submarines down to the bottom of the Arctic to try to plant a flag and claim stuff. They're up there, and they're investigating, and they're developing the Arctic, but we're just beginning. You know, I think tourism is another thing that will really open up once it's going to warm up. You know, that's an inevitable fate that we're looking at right now. It's going to warm up. And I had a professor joke that he had moved to Alaska once Barrow warmed up, and he'd get a beachfront condo in Barrow and just, you know, wait in the Arctic Ocean because it's now 60 degrees or something. I lived in Barrow. When I was a little baby, we lived in Wainwright. And so, I appreciate the Arctic. I know what it looks like. You know, I know how special that is. There's no other place in the United States that's like that. And so I'm really skeptical about developing, say, ANWR up there. And the offshore drilling, I don't think we're ready for that. And I don't know. I mean, personally, I prefer that oil and gas stay in the ground. So that's why that.
Yeah, I think I agree with everything that's been said. I think there's some interesting ideas, for example, for a deep sea port in Nome, if that ever gets figured out, because a lot of that material has to be exploded out because it's not deep enough. And with the warming of the temperatures and the erosion, everything would explode out to probably get backfilled in there over time anyway, so it'd be very costly. So there are a lot of ideas for developing the Arctic. They're costly. I think it's very important, though, to preserve the Alaska Native way of life in those communities. My wife's grandmother was originally from Point Hope, and you know, a lot of those communities engage in whale hunts and so forth, and seal hunts and subsist off the land. And when these types of oil developments go forward, they often don't listen to the Alaska Native people that subsist off the land, and their voices get overrun by development. And we need to make sure that the Alaska Native people have a louder voice when these decisions are made, especially those people who land, who live off the land. And that's what I will be a voice for in Congress.
Chris, I think you start off with this question. All right, we've touched a little bit on mining. Mining used to be a big activity in southeast Alaska. Right now we're looking at mining development over on POW, the Grand Rift levels and so on. So I want to ask you to just discuss your role as our representative in Congress and how you can facilitate the development of those resources.
I'm really excited about mining over on POW. I looked over there a few years ago, right as Niblack and Vocan were starting to come online and people were starting to talk about that. I remember the guys from Heatherdale and UCOR would come in to POW and put on a little conference every year and talk about their progress. I mean, it's hard, though, you know, in Congress to facilitate some of this. Like, it depends on metal prices that are beyond our control. Like, that's the issue with Niblack right now is metal prices just aren't, it's not economic right now. And so I don't really know how much Congress I could do in Congress to facilitate that mine, but Vocan, I think I see real potential there. I'm, you know, with the rare earth metals, that's a national security issue. Most of those metals right now are coming from China, you know, again, and we're in the middle of a trade war with them. So Vocan, I see a lot of opportunity. I'm really excited about, you know, it seems to be they're going to try to do it as a pretty clean mine. You know, it's going to be underground, and they're going to backfill all the tailings when they're done. So it should be pretty environmentally safe, you know. And they're also talking about, I just heard they're going to, UCOR is going to build a processing plant here in Ketchikan. That's the plan right now. They've got a new technology to sort rare earth metals, and so they're going to, the plan right now is to build a plant here in Ketchikan and sort those metals out from Vocan and other places around the world. So Vocan, I see real opportunity there. I mean, they're talking about a couple hundred jobs over in POW that are going to have benefits. They're going to be regular hours, you know, and that's, I mean, that's what POW needs. And then the Quartz Hill Mine and Misty Fjord, you know, I think that, yeah, that's a pipe dream. I don't think, man, I worked for a tour company that did tours over to Misty Fjord, so it's a special place to me. We used to fly out there and take the boat back. And so I just couldn't imagine a mine in the middle in Misty Fjord. It's just, that place is special. It's quiet. It's, you know, it's been preserved. There's not, it's wilderness, you know, and I think that's worth saving. So, Niblack, yeah. I mean, Vocan, yeah, Niblack, I don't know. You know, the Alaska legislature's been helping Vocan. They've got like $150 million from IDEA, so the state's helping out, and I'm sure, I think they're looking for another, like, $100 million to complete Vocan is what they're looking at right now. So I don't know if the feds could step in and help fund that, or if they're going to get private funding. But yeah, Vocan's coming, and so that's what I got.
That's Tom, are you just messing with me when you say POW?
I'm sorry?
Are you just messing with me when you say POW? Like, we're not local.
Oh, I'm sorry. Prince of Wales.
Prince of Wales. Let's go play south. So in general, I think mining produces good jobs. We should make sure that there's a clean environmental plan, that there's a plan to contain the byproducts and the runoff, and to make sure we can do it in the least environmentally damaging way. We should never trade one resource to another for another. Like salmon and fisheries are renewable resource. We should not be supporting mines that will leach and will eventually destroy fisheries. So that is my concern, and that's my position. And second, like yeah, Chris mentions, there are beautiful places around Alaska that should not be disturbed, and that's why the local people should have a greater say in these developments, because we live here, or you live here, and we live in Alaska, and we should have a say about these developments. And I will make sure that Alaskans will have a voice in Congress when these things come up.
So similarly, I also support responsible resource development in Alaska, and that includes mining, but it has to be done right. And I support strong local input into the state and federal permitting process. I mentioned earlier coastal management. Bring it on back, or some sort of systemic way that is sure to allow for that local input. Don't count on me to speak up for every community necessarily, or culture. I think it's important that we set things up systemically for you to be able to have a place at the table with power when it comes to that sort of input. It's really important. And in terms of the permitting process, I think that it has to be very strong, and that's why I'm particularly concerned about the transboundary mining and the role of Alaska's communities in such permitting decisions. The Niblock mine that you mentioned, underground gold, zinc, copper, silver deposits, all kinds of things. And it's just a few miles away, right, on Prince of Wales. As I understand it, the current developer is evaluating whether or not it's economically even viable. That what you understand too? It seems like Chris is the expert. Leaning over to him, but that's my understanding.
Niblack's been temporarily closed since 2012, so that is metal prices.
Yeah, so I'll be watching that project as it advances through the various review processes, and I think that they need to happen.
Yeah.
As far as the Volcan Mountain project, I think it's intriguing. Rare earth mineral project. These minerals are critical raw materials for our modern technology. Just like cell phones, right?
Yep.
And currently China is the primary producer of these necessary components. It's critical to our national security and our modern economy that the U.S. has access to rare earth minerals outside of China. I appreciate that. So particularly in light of the reckless trade policies of Trump, we do not want to find ourselves shut off from our only supply of these materials, as Japan did a few years ago. Because China can manipulate the market price for these minerals, any project is unlikely to go forward without some assurance of an economic sales price. I believe it is incumbent of the federal government to enter into supply contracts with mines, such as the Volcan, to provide the financial security to see the project proceed. Of course, as I said, any mining must be done in an environmentally responsible way and must prove that through a very robust permitting process that has to stay in place. You didn't ever address the molybdenum?
Yeah, that's Quartz Hill.
So that's the one you were saying.
Yes.
I'm not sure. So my understanding is that that's like kind of not even.
Yeah, not even
yet.
No.
Okay. So I'd be interested. I can hardly pronounce the name, but I'm working on it, and I'd be interested to hear if there's any more progress comes that way, but so far I don't think it's been advancing. I'd be interested to hear if there are any advances, and of course, to be allowed, they would of course have to be going through in a responsible manner and go through the same permitting process as any other mine. So that's how that's where I stand with mine.
I have failed as your moderator. We've gone way into the audience questioning time. So, I had several more questions here.
Yeah.
There's a button on the bottom of that mic on the.
It's on.
Oh, okay. So the mic is on. First come, first serve. Go ahead. Excuse me, you can address your questions to one or all of the candidates.
Thank you, Tom. First, you guys that are running, when you're voting, just because your party submitted this bill, you don't vote for it. You vote from your heart and what's good for your people. This is what's wrong with our system. Our system is so funny that they spend more time fighting each other than solving the problem. That's a must. Now let's get to mining. Mining has destroyed 29 states in the United States, contaminated the ground, the waters, your food that you're eating now, most contaminated. Okay, now you take a look at, nobody believed Mike Fay. I worked close with Mike Fay. He couldn't get anybody to work when he was talking about the eunuch and the chickman. In 2008, they closed that mine where they took $10 billion in gold out of there and buried all the waste right there by the Eunuch River. Many of you guys know there's no river running right outside of this store. But you drill a hole, what do you get? Water. You got to understand, when you're burying that waste, you got more underground rivers than you do above. So when that thing is buried there, you don't know what direction it's going to head. Now you take a look at the eunuch again. Mike says, Frank, they're chasing the hooligans out. But the Forest Service, you talk to them, fish and game, turn a blind eye. Something chased those things out of there. What? That mine that closed in 2008. He came back and he said, Frank, I've been testing the water. Him and I were close together. The king salmon are moving. He said, the silvers are getting less between the chickman and the eunuch. And you should know that you're talking about going to Bethel. 2015, the household was only allowed up and down that river. How many villages in that place? 25, 35 villages, I think, along the river. We're only allowed 5 kings per household. Why? Okay, you take a look at what I don't like. These mines like the Mount Polly. What happened when that thing broke? How many people suffered?
Right. Could I ask you to get to a question?
Yeah, I'm coming to it. How many do I have? I have 10 minutes, you said? Okay, what I want to ask is that, what I'd like to see on this mine, somebody has to pay. Why does the fisherman suffer? How are you guys going to push something like this? Like, we sent those things to Don Young and sent it to Lisa. And that, we're the ones that suffer. I'd like to know what you guys are going to do about it. Where we get these, you take a look at the Valdez. I lost 128 skates. The oil, I never even got confiscated. So, sure, they're fine big, but what about us? What about the fishermen? That's what I was wondering. You guys got some kind of backwards to compensate the fishermen? To anyone you...
All right, so I will say that, I think the best policy is to prevent these kinds of disasters from happening. I've worked in Bristol Bay, and I haven't worked much in this region, but I know that people of Bristol Bay, they know what's coming, like the Pebble Mine, for example, and that's why they oppose it. And I have, and being an accountant and formerly CPA, an auditor, and having worked with corporations, I know how it works. They extract as much gold and silver as possible, and then if the containment starts leaking and it costs too much to contain, they just simply distribute the revenue and profits to their shareholders, and they file for bankruptcy. While fishermen are left holding the bag and paying the price and suffering, and the families are suffering. So that is why when I'm in Congress, I will not support projects that threaten Alaskans and Alaskans' way of life, because we should not be trading one resource for another, and mining should only occur when there is a very responsible development plan. And this is why we need a strong environmental protection agency, and this is why we need to end the war on science, and we need to respect science. And when science says, you know, like you mentioned, Pebble Mine, there's millions of little rivers right under the surface that will carry this poison throughout the entire region and kill off all the salmon stock. This project should have been dead decades ago, but it keeps coming back, and it keeps coming back, and Dong Yang is supporting this project. So it should not go forward, and I will oppose other projects.
One little one, Tom. Is this thing, what I'd like to see is...
Frank, I need to get someone else.
Hurting us, so I need some kind of bill to push in to protect the fishermen.
Agreed.
That's what I'm asking. So, okay, thanks, Tom. I thought it was 3 minutes ago.
Do you have any comment?
Well, I just would add that I think that we do need to focus on a science-based decision-making when it comes to, in terms of bills, we can, when we're looking at, right now, mining has some permitting process that's pretty stringent, but when we're looking at mines like Pebble, and they're saying that they're reducing their watershed impacts from 13 watersheds to, I think it's now down to 4, it's still 4 watersheds. It's just we need to ensure that there's not any watersheds affected by our mines. That's just too much at risk. And so it is something that can be accomplished on the front end. That's mostly state permitting that's in place that's fairly strong. But we need to, on the federal front, also ensure that there are pieces put in place that are, I don't know that there are the bonding requirements like they have in oil and gas, but the bonding requirements really need to be upped if anybody does anything that could remotely have a chance. And I'm not sure about all the mines here locally, but perhaps if there's burying tailings, if there's any watershed there, then there would be an opportunity, and they should have to have bonding in place so that if there is any impact, they should be substantially working toward changing that to reverse the effects, but also working with the fishermen so that they are well compensated. I know that in Louisiana, what a mess. Those fishermen lost their livelihoods for years, and some of it hasn't even come back. It wasn't just fish, it was shrimp and other things, but you know, we need to make sure that we're looking after our people. That's it, our people. People. We need to bring it on back to government of the people, not of the corporation.
Thank you.
Yeah, the only thing I want to add real quick is I see this as a big transboundary issue. You know, BC is going crazy building mines, you know, in rivers, you know, that produce our fish. That's where our fish go to spawn. And, you know, so I think that's a big part of the problem is, you know, like Mount Polly, like you mentioned, who's going to clean that up, you know? The Canadian government's going to end up cleaning that up, and that's something we got to look at. We got to really think about with our minds is what's going to happen if who's going to clean it up? Who's got that money? And so, you know, I'm always kind of skeptical with these, like, Canadian companies, like with Niblack, where it's owned by a company that doesn't really do anything, and it barely has any money. So if there's a disaster there, state's going to pay for it. You know, we're going to be paying for it. So I don't know. We got some real in Congress. This is an international issue with Canada. I don't know what we can do right now. I know we've been talking with them, but, you know, it's hard. You know, it's almost something we can't control. So, I don't know.
Well, thank you. That's one little comment, though. But anyway, when you bury that tailings, is like bluestone. I don't know if you guys know what bluestone is. People used to throw it in the creek, and it killed the creek off. And that thing stays there just like tailings. It never runs out.
That's sometime after 8 o'clock or something.
Yep.
Let me ask you in the audience to please try to make your questions concise. I need to give as many people as want to ask a question a chance to do that. So I can't be as patient as I'd like to be from this point on. So,
all right. The Alaskan Democratic Party platform calls for the restoration of full employment policies. What are your positions on the federal job guarantee, the proposals for federal job guarantees circulating in the Democratic caucuses in Congress? Thank you.
Let's see, I think Dimitri did.
Yeah, I will take a stab at it. I think those proposals are along the lines of they almost sound like universal basic income. And, I mean, that's what job guarantee would be, I think. It's saying that if you wanted work, you would get a job. I don't know how it would match qualifications to... I'm not familiar enough with these proposals, but I would think they're very forward-looking. And I think we need to get to the basics. And the basics, and we need to catch up to other industrialized nations. And we have to start with providing universal health care coverage and then push forward with other grand ideas. So let's take care of health care for Americans, because that will provide freedom to move around from job to job, not to be tied down by health insurance. Like in the Soviet Union, they used to assign you to an apartment. Here we assign people to an insurance policy and they can't move anywhere. So we need to end that practice.
Okay, so you're favorably disposed, but you think health care is higher priority.
Excuse me, steps. After 8 o'clock.
I just want a clarification.
Please, you can take it later. Let's move ahead.
Sure, I think it's a really great concept, because it's really important that everybody has an opportunity to have a self-sustaining life. What we might work on first is our education system and better connectivity to jobs. There's a lot of jobs, for example, right here in Alaska that we're not capturing or not having a connectivity from high school on to apprenticeships and then into careers. We're going to be really short. Plumbers, electricians, even painters, real soon. I'm hearing this from the unions right now, and they're ready to give free education. And we're just not connecting those 70% who are not going on to the four-year college to these opportunities. I would start by doing that, but I absolutely would entertain that concept, because everyone who graduates needs to have a pathway toward a livable wage with wage growth, toward the basics that are necessary for every family to be healthy and strong, which includes not just wages, but also health care, also affordable housing, a sense of what child development is, and a sense of a strong community. All of those things I'm absolutely supportive of. And I would entertain that right away and look toward what we can do to strengthen opportunities for every American to have a job.
I support it. I think it's an issue that, you know, like universal health care, a couple of years ago, we wouldn't be talking about that, you know, and now it's, you know, it's what the party's running on this year, in part. So I think this is an issue that it's going to take some time to develop. You know, we've got to figure out how to pay for it. I haven't heard, you know, a lot on that end, but I'm sure there's a way to do it. But, yeah, I support it. I know I'm unemployed right now. I know what it's like to not have a job. It sucks, you know. It hits here, you know. So I totally support it. Just so being unemployed sucks. I'll stop there.
Thank you, Tom. Yeah, let's talk about a little bit about everybody's interest, and that's jobs and the economy. I've lived here quite some time, and what I'm seeing, and it's been happening for a number of years, is I'm seeing shiploads of logs leaving here, which every time I see them happening, it's jobs leaving, and it's affecting the economy. Industry says they got to export. So that's even Viking on Prince of Wales, who's crying that he doesn't have a supply, but he's exporting. So I guess my question to all of you is, as a member of Congress, will you remind your colleagues in Congress that this is a national forest, it doesn't belong to the timber industry, and if we're going to cut, whether it be second growth or old growth, process it here, but it's valuable wood.
Right.
Would you support something like that happening in Congress and keep reminding them, beat your colleagues over the head that this belongs to all American people because it is a Tongass national forest, not the timber industry forest? Would you support something like that and advocate for it?
Sure, that's where one part that I kind of disagree with Chris has more, where everyone, I think it's a very popular thing to say, let's like bring, all of this belongs to Alaskans, and, you know, well, how would we feel if, you know, if folks in Arizona went and filled up the Grand Canyon with dirt? I don't know. Like, what all these states start just clear-cutting their national parks and national monuments and et cetera. So we are part of a country. And this is preserved for everybody in the country. And this is preserved for this generation and future generations. So I do, I will stand up to, and I will stand up for this notion that national parks are national parks for a reason. National forests are national forests because they belong to everybody. Yeah.
Thank you.
Please.
Absolutely, they do belong to everybody. I think that there's been a lot of talk around whether or not you can retain its worth in terms of the beauty and everything else, and also have multi-use. And I frankly am not one who's privy to all of the research around that. I'll be honest, I would need to study it more. I believe that I've heard from many other locals that there might be an opportunity for some small, I'm not talking about large corporate use, but there might be some way to have some small mills and small usage based on local input, but also it's important to preserve the overall beauty that we've all enjoyed over time.
Yeah, I'll just add, I think in Congress, I would support a program to, like, maybe through the Small Business Administration, to help small mills, you know, like, over in POW, I knew a guy that made guitar tops for Gibson, and then they get shipped to China to finish the guitar. I don't know why we can't be making guitars over in POW, you know? We just need some infrastructure. I think people would like an Alaskan-made guitar, you know? And then there's, you know, like the using the waste wood to make pellets for heating. That's an interesting concept. And then, you know, I just know, like, here in Alaska, we import our lumber for construction and stuff. And I know guys on POW that can cut a 2x4 or whatever, like, an expert, you know what I mean? Like, a craftsman. And I think we just need money, you know? We need to get in there. It's hard to get started, you know? Like a small mill or something, you got to have some capital to get started in that. And so I think we've got a big opportunity, like, because the small mill guys, like, they do well. They make good money. And they're not cutting down all the forests. They're, you know, it's
right.
Selective logging, so.
Well, it's been tried for a long time.
Yeah.
It's been suppressed by the big the big guys. Yeah. There are small mills over at PLW that are doing well and producing a great product. And when you talk about importing wood, go down to Madison Hardware and buy a 2x4.
Right.
You know, drive a nail in it, it splits. But it's got a grade stamp on it. Where the wood over there doesn't. And depending on the building code, you got to have a grade
stamp. That's where your wood is.
So we got to get, I guess overall, we got to get creative with our what we're using. And look and keep in mind that it's jobs and economy. You could have a lot more jobs and put money back in the economy if we wouldn't be loading our products on long ships.
Yeah.
So thank you all.
Any other questions?
No, I think that'll.
Okay.
Thank you, Tom.
I'll bring up a subject that. A little bit my past to some extent, except I've got a second generation that it affects deeply, which means my checkbook too, and all of ours, is the cost of education. And you have people that are foregoing going to college, training schools, graduate schools, because they can't afford it. And if they do go, then they have this huge debt and seem to have no choice, but you know, you're kind of chained to a job. Because you have that big nut you've got to come up with every month. I understand. I was in local government for 11 years, trying to figure out every time we go to the mill levy, you start your budget, everybody wants to spend money, and then you come to the tax time, and you've got to pay for it. How do you address the issue? Well, we don't want to raise taxes, don't want to spend more money, but how do you help get rid of that load off people that it costs them if they're going to try and get the training that will get them good paying jobs and will work in the long run, benefit the economy?
Elise, go ahead.
And you're referring to solely higher education, correct?
No, I'm talking about both.
Overall, okay, good.
I'm on the ceiling trying to place kids in maritime academies and at a deck crew, not just officers. So both things, to get skills, you want to become an electrician, you want to become a pilot. The big chunk of money, and a lot of people have to just walk away from it.
That's right. So with regard to cost of education on the dime of feds and state, which is very expensive to educate here in Alaska, and as we want to think through cradle to career, not just K-12, we want to think all the way through it as a system that wants to ensure that every child has the same opportunity, right? I think that healthcare is the number one cost driver that's going up in education. I spent a lot of years studying this, and that's why when I would go down to D.C. and in Juneau, I'd say, look, I know I'm here as the education advocate, but what is completely erratic with regard to costs of education is healthcare. And so that is the number one piece that needs to get fixed first, because there's no predictability in the cost of education. It's not that wages are going up. And I know it's true that the lights and electricity and other things related to education are going up, but mostly it's healthcare that's so erratic. So we absolutely have to fix that first. With regard to let's start with the lower end. It is an investment well worth it and then some. John Heckman, one of the famous economists who's looked at the return of investment for pre-K or early learning, says you get your dollars back times 14. So I do believe we need to invest first in that front end, ensuring that not only families have less stress at home, which means all kinds of things that I mentioned already earlier, jobs with livable wages, healthcare, et cetera, but also it means that they have access to early learning that's high quality, so that when those kids arrive, they're arriving at kindergarten ready to learn. Their brains are not stressed. And it's really important that we get that, because in Alaska, only 30% of our kids are arriving ready to learn at 5 and 6 years old. The rest of the nation is twice that. We're half. And that's because we have the least investment in pre-K per capita in the entire nation. Other states are getting lots more federal dollars to support our youngest children. We need a champion in Washington, D.C. that's looking after this. I firmly believe that would help a lot, because then when we end up showing up not ready, the cost that it takes to get people up to speed, and oftentimes they don't, we've learned through looking at the research, they don't see that in themselves, they don't see themselves as learners, nothing wrong with them. It's just that they haven't had that opportunity. And so we need to ensure that we have those kiddos ready. And then in the K-12 experience, I think we need to bring in more hands-on learning, more opportunities for those students to be in classes that aren't bulging, that have opportunities for real relationships with teachers, and they get to develop their sense of wonder in learning. That's going to take resources, but it's resources well spent, because otherwise we end up with them not having jobs and not having job skills and the employability skills that we know are so necessary. We also need to focus on linking every child to have a vision for what they're going to do early on. In middle school, they should be thinking about whether they want to learn coding or whether they want to go into shop and learn other skills, whether they want to be science-oriented, all of that. They should be given all of those opportunities early on, and then throughout their high school, and then connectivity to either opportunities for apprenticeships, and the unions are willing to pay that for them. Of course, they still have to pay their rent and other things that we need to work on helping out. But there are some great opportunities there to ensure that they're getting jobs with livable wages. And for college, we absolutely need to fix the cost of college. We've blown it, and I think that the government needs to fix that. I'll leave it at that.
All right. So, yeah, education costs are something that's, you know, I got a student loan, too, that's in 5 or 6 digits. I went to law school, too, so I can appreciate the cost of education. The student loan, there's a bubble there, you know. All us millennials who went to college and now are trying to find jobs. You know, education is an investment, but we have the brain drain. What was going on in elementary schools, we're educating kids, we're investing in kids who didn't go on to work down south in Seattle or Portland. We don't, you know, so that's $100,000 to educate a kid who's just going to go to college. You know, most of the kids that go to college out of state never come back. 80% of them stay out of state. And so I think, you know, we got to find jobs. We got to keep people here. I think local teachers, you know, we get teachers that come up from down south and spend a year or two here and then leave, and we don't have that continuity that kids need. And then UAA, like, I see it just, like, melting away, you know? And a university, a good university, attracts employers because there's educated employees right there graduating. And our university is, you know, they're cutting back everything, you know? And it's I don't know. It's a money thing again. And I think the last thing I've heard is that teachers aren't being compensated. You know, it's not just about money. It's about the benefits. It's about retirement. And, where Alaska's not being competitive with the lower 48 right now is what I've been hearing. Is there's better, you know, teachers can make more money down south. And so, they're leaving. And so, I don't know. You know, it's a jobs question. It's a complicated issue. And yeah, you know, I'm a product of public education. I went to public university. My son's going to public school. I think the last thing I'm going to mention is early childhood education. You know, with my son, he's autistic, and he went to public preschool at Howling. You know, when he was three and four, and he was able to. He was prepared enough to go into kindergarten and graduate kindergarten without any problem because of that early intervention. And so I think I agree. Let's start at the beginning and help kids break the cycle. You know.
I'm going to need to get Demetrius on.
Yeah.
All right. Let me take a crack at this, folks. I'm going to be honest with all of you. We're not going to be done young by listing problems. We need to be talking about solutions. Single-payer Medicare for All frees up 30% of our state budget to invest in education. That's $2 billion we can put towards college for our kids and trade school for our kids. Second idea, second solution, let's repeal the Trump tax cuts and let's take that money and plow it into education so our kids can actually compete with China. Third solution, let's get the banks out of the student loan business. You know what they do in Australia? We don't even have to reinvent the wheel. You know what they do in Australia? Everyone can go to college. Everyone can go to trade school. And it doesn't cost you a dime. You get a tax lien. And when you actually graduate and you get a decent paying job, your tax rate gets bumped up by a couple of percent. So it cuts the banks out completely. So no one has a student loan. So this is how we beat Dong Young. We beat Dong Young by talking about solutions, not talking about laundry list of problems. We should run on clear solutions, and that's what I intend to do. That's what it takes. Thank you, folks.
Okay, it's way past 8 o'clock on my watch, so I'm going to give each candidate a couple of minutes to sum up, and then we can have some discussion if you want to stick around with the debate will be over. And I'm going to start off the closing statements with Chris.
Oh, yeah.
I'd like to thank everybody for coming. This was a really cool experience. I know I'm an underdog in this race. I got a late start, but I think I've got a good platform. I've got solutions, I've got ideas, new ideas to try and approach problems. With the opiate crisis, we didn't get to that, but I support legalization of drugs, and because it's prohibition is killing people right now. And so that's what I'm running on mainly, is to try to bring awareness to this mental health crisis that we've got. People are dying because of it, and I think I can help. And so, win or lose, I hope I can do a little bit of good. I'd appreciate your vote. I think I can beat Don Young because he has never run against somebody like me. I don't know. I'm just grateful for everybody being here tonight and things.
Thank you. Dimitri?
I want to thank everyone for coming today. It's really wonderful to be here in Ketchikan. It's my first time being here. I hope to come here again. I hope it's going to be sunny the next time I come. And tropical, like I've been told about. So I want to tell you that I'm running on the issues that I feel passionate about. Repealing Trump tax cuts, because I'm an accountant. I used to be CPA. I'm a financial person. It's absolutely disgusting what's happening with these tax cuts. I'm running on single-payer Medicare for All because I live it. It's not something I dreamt up. I live it. I know the benefit of a great healthcare system like my wife, who's Alaska Native, all six of my kids are Alaska Native, have. I just take my kids to the doctor. I don't have to worry about going bankrupt. I can run a business. I can start a business anytime I want. My wife, it's how it should be for all Americans. Just, it exists. It exists here in Alaska. We don't have to talk about other countries. Go to a tutor and diplomacy drive in Anchorage. Walk around the clinic. Take it in. South Central Foundation, NUCA healthcare model, best healthcare in the world, written about in New York Times. This exists here in America, and that's what we should be pushing for. Now, I'm going to tell you a story. My wife, Melissa, was on a trail running one day with her coworkers, and she saw a frail little girl on the trail, and she was getting towards that little girl, and folks would pass that little child up, and this frail little child. And my wife knew that something was wrong because this kid was all alone on this trail by herself. And my wife did not pass her by, as others did, because she knew what the right thing was to do. She knew what her values were. She stopped. She asked that little girl what was happening, and that little girl told her that earlier that day, she crawled out of the window, packed some Snickers bars, and ran away from home to save the life of her three sisters. Now, my wife immediately called the police, she called OCS, and she got involved. She did the right thing. She followed her values. And my wife visited with those kids when they were hospitalized at Alaska Native Medical Center. And later on, it became our choice. Do we do the right thing? Do we follow our values? because the kids now were at foster care and they could not find a home. They could not find people to take these kids in. And my wife and I decided to adopt all the four kids and do the right thing. And that's how we make change happen, by individuals taking charge, doing the right thing, following their values. So vote your values, all right? And that's how we'll make this country better. Thank you all for having me here.
Please.
Yeah, well, I started out talking about values and how the reason I got into this business of running for office is that that's not what I was seeing. I wasn't seeing those in leadership voting for what we value as citizens, as constituents, as people. Alaska and our country are at a crossroads right now between North Korea, Russian interference, a second Supreme Court appointee, and children being locked in cages by Donald Trump's government. The stakes could not be higher this election year. Don Young and Donald Trump are making things worse. Don Young and Donald Trump are taking health care away from families who desperately need it. Don Young and Trump are not addressing the recasting opioid crisis here in Alaska. We're in a real serious crisis here that's affecting our public safety as well. Don Young and Donald Trump don't believe in science and climate change and are not helping us build the Alaska economy of the future. We need a fighter who will defeat Don Young after his 46 years in office and stand up to Donald Trump. I am ready to be that fighter, and I have been everything from a small business owner to a fish processor, a waitress, a leader of Great Alaska Schools, fighting for public education and for our kids. I'll be that fighter to fix health care, save Social Security, ensure full support of programs that we need right now to grow jobs. My campaign has great momentum, over 600 volunteers, and nearly 600,000 with zero corporate dollars. All individual donations, along with the endorsement of the National Educators Association, and $4,000 from them. This is a grassroots campaign about we the people, not corporations or special interests. We can defeat Don Young and give Alaska the new leadership and new representation we deserve. But I need your help, and I need your support. And I hope each and every one of you will think about that and join me in this fight. This is not an ordinary year. None of us were ordinary candidates. Alaska is ready for a woman, someone who's going to stand strong, someone who's going to put partisan battles aside to get to solutions, and vote for Alaskans and what we need. And I warmly invite you to be a part of it. I also warmly invite you to join me for music. I'll be at the New Yorker Cafe after this. Come on down and chat with me. I'd love to talk with you. That's how we're going to do this, one by one, living room by living room, through conversations and growing more opportunities for us to hear you so that we can better represent you. That's what government is, listening to people and then going back there and bringing it there as a fighter, tenacious, bold, courageous. That's what I'll be doing. Well, thank you so much. Really, I appreciate you being here, each and every one of you. Thank you.
I want to thank you all for coming, and I want to thank the candidates for joining us tonight and sharing their views about where we're headed. And I want to leave you with one thought. I've listened to a lot of people complain about lousy candidates in the general election. Primary gives us a chance to pick good candidates. Get out there and vote on August 21. It makes all the difference in the world. Thank you.